This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Diary of an Oxygen Thief by Anonymous. Read by Anonymous. 1. I liked hurting girls. Mentally, not physically. I never hit a girl in my life. Well, once, but that was a mistake. I'll tell you about it later. The thing is, I got off on it. I really enjoyed it. It's like when you hear serial killers say they feel no regret, no remorse for all the people they killed. I was like that. Loved it. I didn't care how long it took, either, because I was in no hurry. I'd wait until they were totally in love with me, till the big saucer eyes were looking at me. I loved the shock on their faces. Then the glaze as they tried to hide how much I was hurting them. And it was legal. I think I killed a few of them. Their souls, I mean. It was their souls I was after. I know I came close a couple of times, but don't worry, I got my comeuppance. That's why I'm telling you this. Justice was done. Balance has been restored. The same thing happened to me, only worse. Worse, because it happened to me. I feel purged now, you see. Cleansed. I've been punished, so it's okay to talk about it all. At least that's how it seems to me. I carried the guilt of my crimes around with me for years after I stopped drinking. I couldn't even look at a girl, much less believe I deserved to converse with one. Or maybe I was just afraid that they'd see through me. Either way, after getting into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't even kiss a girl for 5 years. Seriously, not so much as holding hands. I meant business. I think I always knew deep down that I had a drinking problem. I just never got around to admitting it. I drank purely for effect. But then as far as I was concerned, wasn't everyone doing the same thing? I started to realize something was wrong when I began to get beaten up. My mouth always got me into trouble, of course. I'd go up to the biggest guy in the place, look up his nostrils, and call him a faggot. And when he'd headbutt me, I'd say, "Call that a headbutt?" So the guy would do it again, harder. The second time, I'd have less to say. One of my victims stuck my head on an electric cooker ring in Limerick. Stab City. I was lucky to get out of that house alive. He'd done it, though, because I'd been taking the pith out of his lisp. Maybe that's why I moved on to girls. More sophisticated, don't you know? And girls wouldn't beat me up. They'd just stare at me in disbelief and shock. Their eyes, you see. All the pretense and rules dissolved away. There was just the two of us and the pain. All those intimate moments, every little sigh, those gentle touches, the lovemaking, the confidences, the orgasms, the attempted orgasms, all mere fuel. The deeper in they were, the more beautiful they looked when the moment came. And I lived for the moment. I was working freelance in advertising all through this period in London, as an art director. A contradiction in terms, if ever there was one. It's what I still do today. Strangely, I was always able to get money. Even in art school, I got a grant because my dad had just retired and I suddenly became eligible. And after that, I got job after job without too much trouble. I never looked like a drunk. I just was one. And anyway, in those days, advertising was a far more boozy affair than it is today. Because I was freelance, I could be my own man, so to speak. And I would keep myself busy by ensuring I had dates lined up. None of the girls were supposed to know this. The idea was to have an impressive queue so that when one girl neared maturity, usually after about 3 or 4 dates with some phone calls in between, another would be introduced. Then, as one went onto the scrap heap, a new one would take her place. Nothing unusual about my method. Everyone did it. But I enjoyed it so much. Not the sex or even the conquest, but the causing of pain. It was after my crazy night with Penn, more on that in a minute, that I realized I had found my niche in life. Somehow I was able to lure these creatures into my lair. Half the time, I was trying to push them away, but it had just the opposite effect, and the fact that they were attracted to a piece of shit like me made me hate them even more than if they'd laughed in my face and walked away. As for looks, I'm nothing special, but I'm told I have beautiful eyes, eyes from which nothing but truth could possibly seep. They say the sea is actually black, and that it merely reflects the blue sky above. So it was with me. I allowed you to admire yourself in my eyes. I provided a service. I listened and listened and listened. You stored yourself in me. Nothing had ever felt so right to me. If I'm honest, even today I miss hurting. I'm not cured of it, but I don't set out to systematically dismantle like I used to. I don't miss the booze half as much. Oh, to hurt again. Since those heady days, I heard an adage that seems to apply here. Hurt people, hurt people. I see now that I was in pain and wanted others to feel it too. This was my way of communicating. I'd meet the women the first night and get the obligatory phone number, and then after another couple of days, making them sweat a little, I'd call and be all nervous. They loved that. I'd ask them out and pretend I hardly ever did this kind of thing, and say that I hadn't been out a lot in London because I didn't really know the scene. This was true, though, because all I used to do was get out of my head in local bars around Camberwell. We'd agree to meet somewhere. I liked Greenwich, with the river and the boats, and of course the pubs, and it had a great boyfriend-girlfriend feel. Nice and respectable. I'd be half out of it before we even met. But I'd be witty and charming and boyish and shaking. Trying to put me at ease, they'd smile and comment on my trembling, thinking I was nervous to create a good impression. Because I wasn't getting in enough booze, my very being would shudder. I'd have to order 2 large Jamesons at the counter for her every half lager. I'd down the Jimmies without her seeing and then on with the show. Lovely. I didn't really care if I got them into bed or not. I just wanted some company while I got pissed, while I waited for the courage to hurt, to well up in me. And they seemed pleased because I wasn't trying to grope them. Sometimes I would, but mostly I'd be fairly well behaved. This would go on for a few dates. In the meantime, I would encourage them to tell me about themselves. This is very important for the successful moment later. The more they confided and invested in you, the deeper the shock and the more satisfying the moment at the end. So I'd be told of their dog's habits, their teddy bear's names, their father's moods, their mother's fears. Did I like kids? How many brothers and sisters did I have? A sitcom I had to sit through. But it was okay, because I knew I'd be writing her out of the series. She'd talk and talk and talk, and I'd nod. Raise a strategic eyebrow, grimace when necessary, guffaw or feign shock, whatever was required. I'd watch people in conversation and record their facial expressions. Interest? Raise one eyebrow and raise or lower the other, depending on the conversation. Attraction? Try to blush. Not easy, this. Thoughts of what I was going to do to her later helped. And a blush usually begot a blush. That is, if I could muster a blush, she was more likely to blush back. Sympathy? Crinkle the forehead and nod gently. Charmed? Cock your head to one side and smile apologetically. I'd supply these prefab masks on cue. It was easy. It was enjoyable. Guys did it all the time to get laid. I did it to get even. Unkind to womankind. That was my mission. Around this time, I discovered the meaning of the word misogynist. I remember thinking it hilarious that it had miss as a prefix. All I know is I felt better when I saw someone else in pain. But of course, they would often hide how much I had hurt them. Yes, it was a challenge in itself to help her externalize her feelings, but also bloody frustrating to have gone through all that trouble and then not be able to enjoy a dramatic playback. That's why it became necessary to condense everything into one demonstrative moment. Sophie was from South London. She used to do the wardrobe for Angus Brady on the comedy show Aren't You Glad to See Me? I met her at a Camberwell College of Arts party that I had crashed. After her, there was that designer girl, whose name I honestly can't remember, who I'm sure I hurt very deeply because she never called me back. Funny that, because even though I never met her again or even heard her say another word, I knew she had it bad. How do I know? I know. There was Jenny. She was the one who threw the beer in my face. I was thrilled to have had a hand in causing so much rage. Then came Emily. But she doesn't really count because she was as good, if not better, at whatever this is than I was. I kind of fell for her. Laura was somewhere in there. an ex-band publicist with a superb arse that had survived a young daughter. I woke up one morning, and there was an 8-year-old girl watching as I tried to extricate myself from the freckled tentacles of her comatose mother. And then, after she guilted me into walking her to school, I got the feeling that mother and daughter made full use of the men that passed through their lives. Like the Native American and the buffalo, the Eskimo and the seal, the welfare mother and me. And the one who started it all, Penelope Arlington. I'd been going out with her for 4.5 years. Long time. She'd been nice to me, nicer to me than any girl had ever been. When I spoke, she turned her head towards me and seemed to abandon herself to the meaning of my words. I liked that. It was only much later that I found out she was terrible in bed. At the time, I thought she was wanton. She wasn't. But she's the one I regret hurting the most. Why? Because she didn't deserve it. Not that the others did, but she wouldn't have left me if I hadn't ripped her apart. And I needed her to leave me because she was getting in the way of my drinking. And one night, I just cracked up. It had been bubbling for ages. Simmer, simmer, bubble, stew, gurgle. I got completely, fizzingly drunk, and this whole chain of events began to rattle. Why would anyone set out to break the heart of someone he loved? Why would anyone intentionally cause that kind of pain? Why did people kill each other? Because they enjoyed it. Was it really that simple? To achieve a soul shattering, it is better if the perpetrator has been through the same experience. Hurt people more skillfully. An expert heartbreaker knows the effect of each incision. The blade slips in barely noticed, the pain and the apology delivered at the same time. I had grown tired of the girl I was going out with for 4.5 years. I loved her. That was the awful thing about what I'm going to tell you. The possibility exists that she's out there somewhere listening to this right now. The rest of you cover your ears. This is for her only. Pen, I'm so sorry. I needed to hurt you. I knew we were coming to an end. I knew you had started to despise me. You tried to hide how you felt, but it rippled across your face. Disgust. I began to hate you for not having the courage to tell me what you really thought of me. So I had to make up your mind for you. Okay, the rest of you can come back now. It was a Friday night in a pub in Victoria Park. I was out of work early. Yet another ad agency where yet another clutch of concepts had been mass-murdered by yet another ham-fisted creative director. I was sure of one thing. I needed to get soaringly drunk. So I downed pints of beer at an alarming rate. The wizened barman seemed concerned. Then whiskey. By 7:30, I was stumbling. I was to meet Penelope at 8. I had to walk my bicycle around to where we were meeting. Another pub, naturally. Anger, boredom, drunkenness, a bad combination. I began with something like this. How can I dismantle 4 years? Her quizzical look was followed by an evasion in the form of, like my new blouse? Looks like a tablecloth. Hurt look followed by, another? More booze, that would usually work. Girlfriend? Yes, please. Not so much hurt now as bored, looking around the pub. Silence. Then she said, let's go somewhere else. That would usually work too, but I decided that tonight it wasn't going to. Not tonight. Tonight we were going all the way. This was just the perimeter, the initial sandbags of defense. My svelte band of emotional terrorists skipped mischievously over these insults to their training. Sure, let's go somewhere else. I resolved to say nothing between this pub and the next. I succeeded. She was trembling now, unsure. I was trembling too, from excitement. She ordered some drinks from the bar. Fucked if I was paying for them. And I grabbed a seat at a circular table over-ogling other girls. She saw me. She was supposed to. Still no reaction. There were 4.5 years at stake here. Mostly good. Why wouldn't she allow me one off night? But that's what was so exciting. I'd decided, and she couldn't see what was in my head. The picture of me having sex with that white-skinned, blue-veined prostitute with only one breast. I knew I could cripple Pen. She could probably cripple me too, but she wouldn't because I was going to do it to her first. Why, though? I knew it didn't make sense. I did love her in my own way, very much. She was beautiful and fun and caring, but I was bored, so bored. I had to think of other girls to get a hard on. I didn't want to start the long, arduous road to her orgasm, let alone mine. Afraid to touch her in case it was mistaken for an application for sex. So in order to feel something through the numbness, I decided to perpetrate on my soul and hers the equivalent of quenching cigarettes on my paralyzed limbs. My hope was that if I registered pain, it would be welcomed as a sign of life. Or maybe I was just drunk. Either way, my resolve had hardened. This is what I looked like when I'm pretending to listen to your boring conversation. I froze my sweetest expression, my innocent blue eyes widening in pseudo-interest, the same expression I'd used on teachers. Penn eyed me with suspicion. Here was something new. I turned my face away, like an impressionist readying himself for his next character. This is what I look like when I'm pretending to be in love with you. I gazed at her lovingly but respectfully, the way I had done so many times and meant it. I even meant it now, but only because I wanted it to be convincing. Hang on, what else? Oh yeah, here's what I look like when I'm pretending you are even slightly witty so I can get laid later on. And I threw my head back in a guffaw with a head tilt and a sneaky look out of the corner of my eye. Sorry, girls. Guys know all this stuff, too. She was starting to catch on. Her eyes dulled. I could help her with that. And this is me. This I particularly enjoyed. It had been the catchphrase of Ted Carwood, a very popular British impressionist, who'd end each of his shows with that revelation before he bid us goodnight. It was the one time he appeared as himself. I added a variation. The accompanying expression in my case was one of pure provocation, a mixture of hit me and fuck you that I normally reserve for barroom fights with men much bigger than me. It always worked. I was saying she was a coward if she didn't hit me. She didn't, of course. She just looked at me, innocently. This was more fun than I had expected. Shouldn't she at least be crying? I was impressed, if you want to know the truth. But up to this point, I was merely doing stretching exercises. You think I'm joking, don't you? No response. I'm going to dismantle us tonight, and there's nothing you can do about it. You'll have to sit there and listen while I wrench the U from the S. You'll question your own judgment. Maybe you'll never really trust yourself again. I hope so. Because if I don't want you, and believe me, I don't, that I don't want you being happy with someone else when there's any doubt I might get another girl. I was not yet aware, you understand, that I was to become the soul furnace you see before you. I was losing the bold uprightness I felt I deserved, so I added, "Your cunt is loose." She heard it, but wasn't quite sure how to react. I could help her with that, too. Let me put it another way. Your vagina is baggy. Feels overused. Now we were cooking. Her eyes widened. I saw how she tried to keep her outrage to herself, but it was too late. I was already in there. I could almost see out through her eyes. She couldn't hide. Not from me. I was the undercover cop. I knew all her moves. I'd helped her create them. This was too easy. Your tits sag. This I delivered like a punch. I leaned back to better view the effect. They're too big and they hang too low. This just in case there was any doubt. Shock can protect and lessen the full velocity. Better to be sure you've hit the mark. Mind you, a little confusion is sometimes fun because it makes for wonderful expressions. Often she'll smile at you after delivery of the despicable package, not yet aware of its contents. To get a hard on, I have to think of some girl I've seen on the bus. I waited for this to sink in, brought my hand up to my chin as if thinking of the next line. Looked as sweet as I could. I'm good-looking when I'm enjoying myself, or so I've been told. By the way, I've had sex with another girl other than the one I told you about. Now I was winning. So I smiled with sympathy. A winner doesn't want to gloat, just to win. She looked like someone else. A new person. There was nothing more for me to extract. I wasn't even sure I wanted to hear what would come out. No matter how well chosen the words were, the voice couldn't always be trusted to carry them. Clearing the throat, that was the dilemma. Clearing the throat without letting him know how this affected him. Why was he doing this? Never mind why. The thing is, it was happening. Had enough? No hesitation. Just one nod of her head. Down and up again. She must have sensed mercy in the air. She sensed wrong. All she'd done was let me know that I was having the desired effect, that she was sobbing inside. Yes, well, even so, I've done much worse than just have sex with another girl. It's very bad, even by my standards. So bad, in fact, that I'm going to spare you. I might tell you later, I might not, but you would fall apart if I told you, and I'm not sure I want you doing that just yet. She was so much in shock there was no point in continuing. Did I feel remorse? Not in the least. To further my torture, I inquired about her job and her blouse and her life. I was careful to utilize some of the facial expressions I'd already immortalized so as to inflame her even more. And I seem to remember scrounging some money from her to buy more drinks. But wait, there's something else. Here's the weird bit. Because I had now given her good reason to take revenge on me, I offered her some options. The keys, as it were, to me. I think this is where I miscalculated. My logic went as follows. If somebody hurts you, then you automatically want revenge. It doesn't matter how long it takes, you want revenge. I thought if I hurt her enough, she would want revenge. Therefore, I wouldn't have to worry about never seeing her again. Because that is what I feared most, the fact that I was losing her. The question was how not to lose her for all time. I gave her some hints on how to successfully hurt me back. Love in disguise. Never let her know how much you love her, or she'll kill you with it. Sadly, though, there is still a little truth in that for me even today. But never mind that. We're talking, Jesus, was it 10 years ago? Yes, I believe it was. Call me every night at 8 for a few weeks, and when I answer, don't say anything. Make sure there is no music in the background. By the way, I've always wanted to fuck your sister. I think she would have gone for it, too. I want you to remember these things I'm asking you to do. I know there's some guy sniffing around you at work, and I want you to go away with him for the weekend. Why not? You deserve it. Just go. Don't give me any warning. I won't even remember what I'm saying to you now. I'd probably have a blackout. I'll move on to brandy next. That always gives me blackouts. So you'll do it? Good girl. Also, follow me around in your car. Maybe you'll even change your car. You can use Paul as a messenger if you like. You want to be free, don't you? Especially after tonight. Yeah, of course you do. Well, then do these things or I'll badger you forever. I'm serious. Maybe you'll only do some of them. That's okay. And you may come up with some of your own ideas, and that's fine too. But I want you to take revenge on me. I want you to hate me. I'm helping you to hate me. I'm doing you a favor, setting you free and asking you to do the same for me. Please? I had delivered this monologue with as much sincerity as possible. I was in earnest. I wanted her to want to hurt me back. This would be the new us. She looked at me, into me. Those beautiful eyes glazed over, all shiny like little blue bruises. And yet she looked stronger than I'd ever seen her. Unattached, single, out of reach. My reach. It was done. 4.5 years. I had to make sure she would continue to know me. At the same time, I didn't care. I needed something, anything to push me forward, over the edge if necessary. I wanted to blame her for what might happen. I wanted to mythologize her, she who would avenge the one who dared rebel. Romance has killed more people than cancer. Okay, maybe not killed, but dulled more lives, removed more hope, sold more medication, caused more tears. Looking back, I see that's what it was, me auditioning for Heathcliff in Hackney. I threw in a few more choice insults. Your father's an idiot, your brother's anal, you're not clever enough to be my girlfriend because I'm a genius, and I'm tired of pretending to be less clever than I actually am just so you can catch up, and headed off to the bar for brandy. As you can see, I did recall most of the details, but there could well have been more. For her sake, I hope not. That night, while trying to eat a kebab, I did fall off my big black bicycle somewhere around Victoria Park. I didn't care if I got up off the tarmac. I was laughing and singing Born Free, and somehow cycled back to her place later that same night. As usual, she'd left the door open for me. I remember thinking, the bitch, she hasn't taken me seriously. But when I clawed roughly into bed beside her, I could feel the vibrations as she cried herself to sleep. I remember her getting dressed the next morning, writhing into matching white underwear. She was stunning as she stood in front of the mirror. The expression she wore while deciding if she liked how she looked contrasted sharply with what locked into place when she caught me staring at her. I might have been some homeless guy peeping from under those covers. She went away with that guy from her office. I wasn't prepared for the pain of this. I felt how she must have felt when I hurt her. You might as well argue with the mirror as argue with each other. After all, aren't we all really the same person? Anyway, I have this to say. After Penn left, someone did call me at one point every night at 8 for about 2 weeks. That really freaked me out. I'd answer and nothing. Whoever it was would then gently hang up. The gently scared me more than anything else. Passionless. This intrigue suited my paranoid delusions, and my drinking had by now progressed from habit to full-time occupation. It was going to kill me, and I welcomed the prospect. I attributed my misfortune to the guile and cunning of this mousy girl from Stratford-upon-Avon called Penelope. And while I flattered myself that she'd seek revenge, I didn't realize that leaving me to stew my own paranoid juices was revenge enough. I'd do worse to me than she could ever dream of achieving. When I was nearly sandwiched to death between a car and a motorcyclist, I was able to imagine she'd orchestrated the whole event. I suffered a crushed bicycle and a broken wrist. How delighted I was that she would go to such trouble in the name of romantic revenge against me. She really must love me after all. I couldn't piss because my left arm was unusable and my right was road-rashed. Bladder ablaze, both arms stuck out like I was begging for money from the other would-be patients in the emergency room, and I was smiling. Because Penelope loved me enough to mastermind this attempt on what was laughingly referred to as my life. I fantasized that she would turn up in a nurse's uniform any second and administer a long, slow, luxurious handjob. But only after she'd helped me take a long, slow, luxurious piss. Later, I convinced myself that she had turned up at my shitty basement flat, disguised as a prospective flatmate. I refused to take this applicant seriously. When she asked where the toilet was, for instance, I resisted the urge to applaud. I thought it hilarious that she, having been in the flat hundreds of times, should ask me so convincingly anything about it. She knew more about it than I did, since I was very often in blackout. But I wasn't about to ruin her little sketch. I received each query with a congratulatory smile and answered tongue-in-cheek. Smiling too broadly and nodding knowingly, I showed the young woman out. She didn't take the room. So there's me. My baby'd left me for another guy who had his own flat, a car, and a coat. I was entering a world of pain. Not all of it mine. Cue the country music. 2. So now I was ready to pass on my learning to the uninitiated, the unhurt, the innocents. With the girlfriend out of the way, I'd be better able to dedicate myself. I was seriously pissed off, and all I wanted was for others to feel this too. Especially girls. A girl had caused it, so a girl would have to pay. I wanted to hurt. It was a whole new world to me. I'd never known it possible to be hurt so much. I'd been beaten up lots of times, and it was nothing like this. I hadn't expected physical pain. A burning sensation in my chest as if a large smoldering boulder had somehow lodged there overnight. A kind of drawn-out, slowly unfolding panic. The exact opposite of excitement. Accompanying this were the shooting pains running down along the back of my arms. What was this? Rejection? Was it really this tangible? All I could think about was that if I could be hurt like this, then surely I could cause the same pain in others. This consoled me. I studied and stored away each new flinch of discomfort. I recorded what had happened and how it affected me. I called and asked her answering machine to hurt me. To be free, I needed to hate her. It was over, but I couldn't bear the fact that I still needed her. so I begged her to hurt me, which she did by refusing to. Meanwhile, I stumbled into London's night in search of hearts to stab. A teacher from Ireland, 25-ish, a virgin. No, really. She said I had an enviable command of the English language. I wasn't sure what I was going to do to her. The answer came to me when I slipped into her bed after cooking my special boned chicken, the preparation of which scared even me because it involved so much tearing of flesh from bone. She was engaged to be married. I hated her for that. It emerged in conversation that being a virgin embarrassed her. She didn't want her fiancé to find her still intact on their wedding night. I didn't know where to start. Teach her some filthy tricks that would sow seeds of doubt in the mind of the groom. For instance, I've never thought much of a girl who swallows. Don't get me wrong, it feels fantastic and I'm aglow with gratitude at the time, but only a slut would ever actually do something like that. Not the behavior of a wife-to-be. Somehow it was obvious that I should leave her virginity intact. It became about him. How to hurt him through her. Anal sex? That would still leave her as a virgin. Did she really want to lose her virginity, or was she bluffing? After a huge bottle of wine, most of which I drank from the bottle, I was supposed to sleep on the couch. This I did until 4, when I awoke with a stiffy and slipped in beside her, finding only token resistance. She really did want to lose it. But I didn't like the idea of me as sexual plumber. I wanted to be present on her wedding night. I wanted her body to remember mine the way I remembered Penelope's. I began to lick her out. For 2 hours. When she became too sensitive, I waited and started lapping again very gently. I looked up now and then to tell her how beautiful she was. I blew cool air on her. I stroked the insides of her thighs and tried to imagine I was in love with her, behaving accordingly. I pushed a finger in and could feel the stalactite of her hymen. I was careful not to break it. At one point, I had a finger either side. She raised her hips, offering the pelvic cup to me. I sipped and drank noisily, satisfied that her wedding night would be the first of many nights of sexual frustration as she tried to communicate her sexual needs to Hubbykins without indicating a lack of sexual prowess on his part. It provided an incentive to develop her very own enviable command of the English language. Next came Lizzie. She had her own flat, beautiful hardwood floors and lovely high ceilings. She also had hairs on her arse. That was crime enough. But crime number 2? She really liked me. Soon take care of that. She was freshly jilted from a long-term relationship and was very delicate. I had 2 others on the go when we met for our first date. My nervousness made Lizzie more comfortable. She thought it was because I was unsure of her feelings for me. The truth was less endearing. I was an alcoholic who needed a drink. I ended up having sex with her on the kitchen floor in the middle of her making some bullshit vegetarian meal, on the dirty tiles as the pots boiled symbolically overhead. The windows steamed up. Her face looked up at me in disbelief, her chin buried under her pushed-up jumper and bra. Eyes wide, childlike. After I left her there like that, I never saw her again. Later, she left a message on my machine saying I'd raped her. Emotionally speaking, maybe I did rape her, but physically she was up for it. No question about it. She was loving it. I could see her already storing away the memories as I fucked her. Her face scanning up and down, recording the images like a flesh-covered camera. Close-up of his face, pan down for a wide shot of the action below. Cut. Maybe there is a law, after all, of nature. Like gravity, an unwritten axiom that governs our emotional dealings. What you do comes back to you with twice the force. Fuck it, 3 times the force. We are not punished for our sins. We are punished by them. From the moment I met Jenny, I knew I was going to hurt her. It was just a matter of where and when. I suppose it was no fault of hers that she even looked a little like Penn. It was that fact that seemed to sanction my actions. After being out all night, I was reluctantly heading in the general direction of what I mockingly referred to as home when I realized I needed more booze. There was never enough of the stuff. I even dreamed about it. One night I was drinking whiskey, and even as it was going down my throat, I was thinking, I want a drink. Tricky one. Anyway, one of the main obstacles to getting more booze was lack of money. And money ran out because I couldn't always depend on getting more freelance art direction. I had no rent to speak of since I was ripping off the local council who paid my rent and electricity. All I had to do was go and sign on the dole once every 2 weeks. parties were a good source, especially parties nearing some sort of end. The amateurs were either passed out on the floor or tucked up at home in their little beds. The music, the brightly lit window. I didn't have to be Sherlock to figure out there was going to be a fridge full of booze. Everyone brought something to appear generous, especially if the area was fairly well-to-do, but that was a bit more difficult because I had to have my wits about me for the inevitably intricate verbal exchanges. I had to resist bursting into flames with the fury I felt towards these fuckers. I hated these people most of all, the ones who had their lives given to them, who in my mind never had to work, who didn't appreciate what they had. As a teenager in Deelford, I'd had to pick sugar beet in freezing cold fields wearing only old socks as gloves. The beet would freeze in the furrows and we'd have to kick each one out of its frozen, hard, earthen socket before snagging the stalk with beet knives. The term hard work is relative. So I'd press the buzzer and say, "Sorry, I'm late." The door would open and I couldn't help smiling as I took the stairs three at a time. If it wasn't already open, the door soon would be. I never looked like a drunk. I just was a drunk. In I went. Hit the toilet first and either puked up to make room for new booze or just get the lay of the land. Then the fridge. Oh, happy white oblong. A miniature hospital in a bruised world. The clink of music as it opened, the glow from within. There. A full and as yet unopened bottle of cheap wine with some assorted cans of beer, stragglers from six packs. Back to the living room with the wine and after getting it into a pint glass so that I wasn't clutching a bottle that might be recognized by its owner. And there she was, sitting all alone, by herself, on a couch at 4 a.m. at a party where there were only three people left standing, and I was one of them. Long-legged and elegant and definitely out of place, she reminded me of a Vogue photo shoot. Beautiful girl in dingy surroundings. The rich, well-read daughter of some English MP slumming it in Camberwell. Anyway, I vowed to fuck her up as soon as I plunked down beside her. Even in my comatose state, I knew that asking her to dance, though not being able to get off the couch, was endearing. Dancing with a pint of wine in one hand and a joint in the other was mischievous. Before either of us knew it, we were kissing. 2 weeks later, she's throwing beer in my face, and 3 hours after that, I noticed her car parked outside my shitty basement flat. I was drunk and wavering on my bicycle. She was in a Ford something or other. As soon as I turned the corner, the car started up and jolted ferociously forward. The vehicle resembled a mechanized insect whose legs had been plucked and was being poked awake for new tortures. I laughed loud enough for her to hear through the open window, which emitted cigarette smoke. I tried to behave as if I was on a horse. She started the engine again and steered it angrily away, angrily because I could hear gears being shoved around. What had caused this futile display of emotion? Mere words. Earlier that evening, she had asked me how I had enjoyed my weekend. "Not bad," I said. "Got laid?" Stunned, she looked at me with the same inquisitive smile that belonged to the question she had just asked. Beer hit my face with such force I thought she'd slap me. But I had not just delivered the line. It had been accompanied by the smirk. Penelope had felt its girth, and now it was Jenny's turn. I'd never had beer thrown at my face before. It was flattering. Jenny rose, whipped her jacket from the back of the chair, and left. After slowly licking some splashed beer from my lips, I exchanged a look with the barman that said, "Chicks," and returned to my as-yet-untouched beer. Not for long. Speaking of slap happiness and the art of the smirk, it had been a long time since I begged to be beaten up. The Swan in South London was the ideal setting for just such an endeavor. Very Irish, very fist-happy. Many, many bouncers. They'd stand on stools, the better to police the goings-on perpetrated by heavily drinking Irish exiles like me. I was deep in conversation with a tall, red-haired man from Dublin. There was much jostling for position as the other exiles attempted to get a little closer to their beloved homeland via Guinness. The spot that the Dub and I occupied was sacred, right in front of the counter. It was necessary to get there at 3 in the afternoon to occupy such a position. I'd been there since 1. So I turned to the Dub and quite truthfully inform him, "I've been listening to your shit all day and I'm fucking sick of it. I wouldn't mind, but to top it all off, you have to be from Dublin." He immediately headbutted me with such force that I was able to see blood dollop into my pint glass. and I debated whether I should try to strain the blood through my teeth in order to salvage the inch of cider left in the bottom of the glass. I began to see it as important that I contain the dripping blood in the glass. Mustn't for some reason get the place all bloody. I decided instead to announce, "One of us is going to leave this bar, and it isn't going to be me." I looked up at my assailant, whose face bore the throes of bloodlust. Freeze frame. I have seen that expression only three times. This was the first. The next was when I was knocked from my bicycle by the hired motorcyclist and was waiting for the ambulance people to ascertain whether I had serious injuries. I was lying on my back, afraid to look down at my legs. On the top floor of a passing double-decker sat an old lady in a brown coat. The bus had to stop, presumably because of the general commotion. The old hag's expression was exactly the same as the one our Dublin friend is wearing now. Look at him, ginger stubble, tongue slightly protruding from between fleshy lips. A cunt, if ever I saw one. Other heads protruded into what might have been my last patch of sky, but it was her face that dominated my wait for the ambulance. Lying there, I was still listening to Elvis Costello's "Accidents Will Happen." I kid you not. My Walkman, although askew, was still on and still playing. The old cow up there looking down from on high seemed to be nodding in time to Mr. Costello's sentiments. I tried to read from the old lady's face how badly I was hurt. I wished I'd known her better, because if she was a complete bitch, the slight smile on her face meant I was fucked and my legs were mincemeat. But if she was a nice, caring person who fed pigeons and stroked strangers' dogs, I was in good shape because she was smiling on my behalf. I decided she was a bitch and I was fucked. The third time I saw the expression was when the girl I loved... Well, hang on a minute. That's what this whole bloody thing is about. We'll get to that. Unfreeze. The Dubliner looked as if he'd just had sex with me. It had taken me this long to realize I'd been headbutted. There was no pain, just a dimming of lights, like someone turning down one of those knobs inside a living room door. "No, we'll keep it clean. No glasses," he said. I immediately knew what this meant. He thought I was going to glass him, or the thought to glass me had occurred in him. I was concentrating my attention on directing the strange dribbling blood, which could well have been coming from the ceiling, into the pint glass in my right hand. For some reason, it had become important not to mess up the floor of the Swan. To be glassed is to receive a pint glass in the face. The mouth of the glass is positioned around the chin and under the nose. A great deal of force is then applied with the ball of the hand to the base of the glass. The handsome face that hovers over the writing of these pages can only wince at the thought of what could have occurred that evening. So there I was, holding a half pint of my own blood, and he wants me in the worst possible way. Suddenly he was jerked upward, as if sucked by a huge vacuum cleaner. Understanding his imminent ejection, the Dubliner reached for the collar of my coat and pulled me along with him. We formed a reluctant conga train, the locomotive for which was two, then three newly unperched bouncers. Ah, yes, nothing like a quiet drink. Dub wanted to get me outside in order to give me a more leisurely pummeling, but I simply stepped out of the coat and back to my position and a freshly pulled pint of delicious draft cider. On the house. One of us did leave the bar after all. My coat was brought back, folded and presented to me by one of the heroic staff of the Swan. Long may it prosper. After Penny, there was, let's see, I can't remember her name. She was, or claimed to be, a designer. Wild, curly brown hair, shiny, attractive, 33, looked 38, old when you're 29. Mind you, I felt 80. "You like trees?" That was all I said to her. She told me later that my question enthralled her. She figured out what I was up to much faster than any of the others. But not in time. I spent an excruciating day with her one Sunday, waiting for night. She cooked dinner, chicken, and invited her two burly brothers. I found out later this happened every Sunday. At the time, I thought it was for my benefit. I never was a dope smoker. I was a drinker, you understand. But I was broke that day, so I smoked as much of that shit as I could. All it did was increase my already prominent paranoia to international proportions. I thought the brothers were going to butt-fuck me as an after-dinner treat and then beat me to death with their white fists. I was high. When it finally emerged, the chicken looked like some felled wildebeest too long in a savannah. Jesus, it frightened me. To my high mind, it was still breathing, a vengeful, seething carcass. Mercifully, someone had brought a bottle of red wine. I had to resist lurching across the table and necking it. One glass I had. And she had the nerve to drop hints about how much I drank. This from a dopehead? Then I had to wait till the whole pathetic brother-sister thing had expended itself before I was allowed to get into her bedroom and eventually her knickers. The fear and paranoia I'd had to endure that day fueled each pelvic thrust that followed. A dagger widening an existing wound. Merely an action that was required in order to hurt her later. The next morning, grateful for the absence of a hangover, I left reasonably refreshed. I even grabbed a piece of chicken on the way out. Never saw her again. Next. Catherine had just broken up with her live-in boyfriend and had a young daughter. I hoped to excel myself here. She'd had some problems, emotional problems. Attempted suicide was touched upon. My ears perked up. I heard, "Kill me." If I hurt this woman enough, I could nudge her over the edge into suicide. I'd be helping her do what she really wanted, and it'd be a good test of my powers. It thrilled me to think I could cause a death by proxy. But she proved too strong or too stupid or both or something. From her, though, I learned the technique that would later save my own life. I hate to be so dramatic, but that, I believe, is how high the stakes were. The pain involved in a premeditated broken heart would easily compare with a case of assault, and yet no court of law would recognize it as a crime. A broken arm heals. She quickly fell for me, and I was in a hurry to get to the good bit. Once I knew she was in, I began the water torture. I became less available until I'd banished her to the wintriest regions of my absence. I waited to hear that she had done away with herself, how handsome I imagined myself at her funeral, or even better, to be burying my dick in someone else as she was being buried in the ground. I can't tell you how insulted I was when she called and cheerily asked how I was. I couldn't believe it. She was supposed to be in a wheelchair, crippled with grief, wearing impenetrable dark glasses and clutching a shiny lock of my flaxen mane before cynically abandoning her life. No. She continued to call and inquire after my well-being, which only increased my ill-being. It was the way to win. I had to hand it to her. I couldn't quite accept her nonchalance, but there it was. In retrospect, I think she just wanted to show how well she was taking it. Otherwise, why call? Indeed, you may ask, why write it all down? Who cares? Don't we all have brown water like this gushing under our bridges? No doubt, but there's a dam up ahead. In my defense, I could talk about how I was abused by a De La Salle brother when I was 9, how I'd felt the whole row of desks shaking as he played with his star pupil in the back, how I had to put a safety pin through the fly of my short pants to prevent this young brother's religious fervor. He'd go up the leg instead, and so I begged my mother to let me wear long trousers. I wasn't old enough, she said, and anyway, it was summer, and Brother Ollie was only being friendly. It wasn't serious abuse. I mean, I never took it in the arse. Brother Ollie was later prosecuted for his crime, and in a way, so was I for mine. And if you like that, here's another. My father was shaving. It was a cold morning in Deilford. The light was on above the bathroom mirror, so it must have been winter. He looked as if he was scraping off a big cartoon beard. I wanted attention and tried something like, "If you don't blah, blah, I can't even remember what I said, I'll never speak to you again." Then slowly, very slowly, he leaned down with great emphasis, the cream-covered face larger and larger as it neared mine. And from under this comical mask came the three little words that meant so much. "I don't care." Even now, I feel like I should have capitalized them. But that was just the effect they had on me. He said them very quietly, as if he wanted to make sure the message was for me only. Or maybe he was afraid my mother would hear. No fear of that. A sort of earthquake took place within me. A panicky crumbling. I'll always remember it. That was the moment I knew I'd have to do this thing alone. This thing being life. Doors closed, like in westerns when the bad guy walks down the street and all the townsfolk slam their doors one after another into perspective. My father was someone who, until then, had been my only friend. My mother didn't even seem to notice I was around, and to my sister and two brothers, I was merely an annoyance who needed to be babysat. Dad was the only one who had shown me any affection up to then. Maybe as compensation. I don't want you staining my newly published pages with your salty eye droplets, so I'll get off this topic now. I will say this, though. Seeds were sown. Maybe this stuff has links to other stuff that happened later. Maybe not. Maybe I was emulating the only relationship I'd ever had by gaining trust and then breaking it abruptly. Do with it what you will. I invited Catherine and some of the others to my 30th birthday party to be held in my back garden. The idea was to create a sort of lasagna of pain. All my ex-girlfriends were to gather in one location. My shitty back garden. These separate personalities, unified by the pain I had caused them, would at last understand the devilish mind that now controlled their futures. Something like that. It was a mess. I was far too drunk to greet anyone. In fact, such sophistication was secondary when all I wanted to do was ladle the contents of the punch bucket into my already bleary-eyed face. At one point, I dispensed with the ladle and drank straight from the bucket. I assumed someone hurt someone somewhere that night, because I never heard from any of them again, except Catherine, who called only to inquire as to whether I was all right. Jesus. Let's just lay a blanket over the proceedings. I was annoyed, though. It was like waking up beside a beautiful girl and not being able to remember the sex. By the way, I mention all this because somewhere out there, these girls are getting on with their lives, and I want them to know what happened to me. That even though I'm walking around free in the world, I did get a dose of my own medicine. And it doesn't matter even if they never hear this. This is just me trying to be honest with myself. Like a 151-page note to self, I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm far more interested in symmetry. The one who threw the beer in my face called me 6 months later, sobbing. This was satisfying to me. And Catherine continued to call and ask how I was. Infuriating. But of course I couldn't let her know this, because it would mean she was winning. Maybe you're beginning to see how futile the whole game was. It went on a while longer until I just couldn't keep up the act anymore. I basically lost the plot. But hang on, I promised I'd tell you about the one time I hit a girl. A long time ago, before all this other stuff, I was in the Mascot Bar in Deilford. I was leaving with a so-called friend, Lennon. I was drunk. So was he. So was most of Deilford on a Friday night. The bar was crowded and we had to push our way through the throng. Lennon was ahead of me cutting a path. An attractive girl turned around and slapped me really hard in the face. Before I knew what was happening, I had punched her. Now, I don't know about the rest of you irreligious fucks, but in Ireland we don't stand for that kind of behavior. I waited outside the pub for the beating I knew I was about to receive. Didn't matter what the extenuating circumstances were, I'd hit a girl. The word rippled through the drunken mass, and it wasn't long before five guys, who I knew quite well, came out and after much apologizing and wringing of hands, proceeded to punch and kick me. But there was no passion in it, and they wouldn't stop till blood was drawn, and no blood would bother to show itself to these amateurs. From my crouching position, I tried my best to insult them. My most reliable jibes had no effect until I accused them of having relatives in Britain. It was over in seconds. I remember shaking hands with them. One refused because he was still hurt by what I'd said. I allowed my bleeding eyebrow to run its course unwiped, an advertisement that justice had been done. Why had she slapped me in the first place? Lenihan had put his hand under her skirt as he passed behind her, and she assumed I'd done it. So I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and slowly I got better. 8 years later, I still go to meetings. I hope I will always go to them. And I stayed away from the dreaded female for the next 5 years. 5 and a half, actually. And my career took off. Big time. I got a job in a renowned advertising agency in London and won awards for the work my creative partner and I did. We were quite famous at one point. My name is still known. I went to my AA meetings in the evenings and worked as hard as I knew how during the day. I suppose I must have been good at it, because I never really found it that hard to come up with ideas. It was the awful corporate politeness that I found so draining. Little did I know that London's corporate world was virtually anarchic compared to its American counterpart. After a while, I became disenchanted with my creative partner in London because I felt he wasn't pulling his weight. I believed myself to be the talented one, and I was sick of working with him. We'd been staring at each other across a desk now for 4 years, and I'd resisted diving across and burying my thumbs in his larynx for the last time. We ended amicably. We really did. He ended up with another partner in the same agency. I was approached by a headhunter to go to a really good agency in the States based in St. LaCroix. As soon as the headhunter said the company's name, I knew it was the right thing to do. I was due for 2 weeks' holiday in France with some of my AA friends, so I said we'd talk when I got back. She was keen that I call him from France. So I did. Kilallan Fitzpatrick's creative director was visiting London for a few days doing interviews. The conversation that started the ball rolling on the events of the following 3 years took place in the rattling hallway of a French farmhouse in the Dordogne, with dogs barking and the mistral shaking the windows. I had no idea what he looked like, but his voice sounded hilariously American, like one of my friends had called to take the piss out of me. The smell of cooking surrounded me, and it must have made me feel more homely than I had a right to, because I pitched myself to this American as the Irish equivalent of Jimmy Stewart, only half his height and talent. It was what he wanted to hear. He virtually fell in love with me. He apologized for St. LaCroix, Minnesota, warning me that the city was no London or L.A. He said St. LaCroix got pretty cold in the winter, but it wasn't as bad as people made off. You could buy a house there, next to a lake, for next to nothing. He thought I was the right sort of age for the job. I was 34. There were lots of lovely ladies working in the agency. He felt sure I'd be popular. Pimp. At the time, though, I was ripe for it. Of course I loved London, but I was bored. I'd gotten the awards, I'd succeeded, time for something new. I told him I didn't care if it was cold, because all I ever did was work anyway. They had heating, didn't they? I apologized to him for not being a smoker or a drinker, knowing he'd be thrilled, since Americans were nervous about the British creative's reputation for hard drinking. Didn't go down well in corporate America. In addition, I informed him that I was at the age where I was thinking about getting married. There followed a long moment of silence, which could only be satisfactorily explained by him punching the air in triumph and straightening his clothes before continuing. He began to talk like someone I'd known for years, dropping all use of the conditional tense in favor of the future. My future. The headhunter called on Monday. "Graham warmed to you quite a bit," she said, and then started using words like visa and resign, which I welcomed. This all took place with my copywriter sitting right in front of me. I had taken to sticking my head, complete with phone, out the window to get some privacy. It wasn't long before I'd resigned and found myself sitting in my London flat waiting for work permits to be approved. I was to work freelance from the flat until I was official. But since I needed to vacate the place to let it out, I moved into a hotel in Hyde Park. I found myself 15 minutes away from my own flat with two strangers living in it, and the ink not yet dry on a 6-month tenancy agreement, and me still without any sign of an approved work permit for the United States. This unsettled state was to become the norm for the next 5 years. If I'd known what was about to unfold, I would have stopped everything and gone home to live with my mother. But thanks to AA, I had also just signed a new lease of life, and I was determined to use it. After all, what was the point in getting sober if I wasn't going to do something with it? And there were newcomers to think of. A crazy bastard like me, heading off to the States for a new career, gave the new AA members hope, or so my sponsor said. I did find myself at home in Deilford for a few days before flying to the States. My parents were excited for me, but sad for themselves. Since I'd stopped drinking, they really did like having me around. I bought them a dictaphone and convinced them, and myself, that we'd exchange taped messages across the Atlantic. Never happened. My dad had a rather nasty, bubbly cough when he was driving me to the railway station. A month into my new job in my new country in my new city in my new house, I got a call from my mother asking the most ridiculous question. "Are you sitting down?" I knew immediately that my dad was dead. Only he wasn't. She said he was doing poorly and that I should expect to come back at any moment. My new bosses were very understanding and even helped me book a flight. You get a cheaper flight if you can prove you have a seriously ill relative. You simply give them the hospital phone number. So I flew back, and I still feel guilty about the fact that I hoped my father would die within the week I had allotted for my quality time at home. "Ever the gentleman," he obliged. He was dusted, dead, and buried with a day to spare, and to my shame, I was back at work the Monday after. Well, I was under pressure, wasn't I? I needed to impress my new boss and my old ones in London. I wanted to show them that they'd made a big mistake by not treating me better. Truth is, they hadn't treated me that badly. It just felt convenient to dislike them.